Alrighty, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. How are we all doing? That's a, yeah, good. Come on, it's 5 o'clock. There's still plenty. There's another hour of this left. How are you all doing? That's better. Cool. My name is Brian Farnhill. This is Elaine Van Bergen, and this is Supercharging Your SharePoint 2010 Solutions. So before we get started, we thought we'd do a quick little introduction, let you know who we are and why you should care what we think. So I'm Brian. I'm a solutions architect for a company called Extelligent Design, based in Canberra. I'm a SharePoint Server MVP, a collaboration platform VTSP, and I also help run the Canberra SharePoint User Group.
Lane Van Bergen, I'm an architect at OBS down in Melbourne, I'm all those things, but also SharePoint MCM, and I help run the Melbourne SharePoint User Group.
Excellent. So, quick run through of what you can expect from our session this afternoon. We're going to do a little bit of an introduction, and then we're going to go through some tips and techniques to do with SharePoint development that we want to share with you guys. So some stuff around delegate controls, some stuff around web templates, creating custom service applications, and time pending at the end, some design tips and general guidelines for development. Then we'll do a bit of a review and a Q&A, and then we can all go and drink. So to get this place started, we thought we'd go with a bit of a comic strip that I like in regards to SharePoint developers. So you get the guy that comes up to you and he says, you know, can you help me make this SharePoint list view do what I want it to do? And the developer that responds with, if I help you, will you actually listen this time? I mean, we sent you on 12 hours of courses. We gave you video tutorials. We gave you cheat sheets. I've even sat with you for 2 hours to solve this exact problem. But let me finish. I am a SharePoint rock star. You know, my deep understanding of SharePoint and other technologies is wasted on people like you. What's wrong with this mouse? That's my cell phone. Oh. Point of it being, there is a point to this. A lot of SharePoint developers can talk the talk. Right. What we want to give you in this session is we want to show you how to walk the walk with the really big solutions. Right. We don't want that.
So one of the key points we really want to get across here is that, you know, there's some key considerations you have to think about when you're doing large-scale applications. And the thing about SharePoint is you often don't actually know it's going to be a large-scale application because you do this nice little SharePoint install and, you know, there's a few documents in there. And then you come back a year later and they're like, here's my terabytes of data and all kinds of crazy things. So really any solution you're planning, you have to start thinking about how it's going to grow and what you're going to do when it gets to a complex point. So we're going to go through some techniques here that will hopefully help you plan some of those things right from the start. So you've got a good base there that you can build upon as things do get larger and your project grows.
Cool. So let's get right into it. And we're going to start with a little section here on delegate controls. So first of all, who's familiar with what a delegate control is when we're doing SharePoint development? Just a bit of a show of hands so I can understand where we're all at. Yep. Okay, cool. There's a bit of people in here. So essentially what delegate controls are in regards to SharePoint is it's a bit of a framework for being able to have placeholders for controls within your pages. All right? So if you've ever tinkered around with customizing master pages and things like that, you'll probably come across the delegate control in the out-of-the-box master page in a few places. Basically, what it allows us to do is use features to drive functionality on our pages. Right? So the delegate control says, I've got a particular ID, and I'm going to have a control loaded here based on a feature that deploys that control with the same thing. So what this allows us to do is we can start doing things like overriding controls and getting control of what's appearing on our pages through turning features on and off rather than having to redeploy things or change, you know, our features to tweak what we're trying to do. Now, you know, that sounds kind of basic, and yes, you have a look at the standard master page and, you know, you get some sort of simple concepts, and we'll go through these in the demos. But you can actually build up to some really complicated scenarios where you could do something like, say I've got a series of web parts to do with authenticating to my website, so logging on through like a Formspace solution or something to that extent. I could push out a web part that instead of just dumping the logon control, dumps a delegate. Then I've got the ability to turn on a feature to say, yes, there's my logon control, my web part displays it. I could then have another feature that says, you know, I want to enable maintenance mode, which means nobody can log in. So I could overwrite that web part through just turning another feature on to display a little message that says, no, you can't log in at the moment, we're currently down. Right, and we've done all that through just turning features on and off rather than having to worry about redeploying stuff, worrying about what effect our web parts are going to have when we, you know, change what's deployed and what's not, and with the minimum fuss involved. So a quick rundown for those who don't know how delegate controls work. I've got some pretty pictures because I figured end of the day, everybody loves pretty pictures, right? So we have a feature on the left here, which has got a delegate control in there. and it's got an ID of TechEd and a sequence number of 100. When I turn that feature on, my delegate control ends up in a database. Depending on the scope of the feature, it'll either be one of the content databases for your web application or the farm config database if it's a farm scope feature. Now, on my page, I can have a delegate control with a control ID of TechEd and a property of allow multiple to false. Now, what this will do is it'll go to the database and say, well, what control am I supposed to render? And SharePoint will say, oh, well, here's the control you need. And it gets rendered out onto the page. All right, so it's done dynamically at runtime. Now, let's take that scenario a little further. What if I've got two features? Both of them have a delegate control with the same ID of TechEd. I turn both features on. They both get listed in the database. Now, the difference here is that they have two different sequence numbers. One of them is 100, the other is 90. So this time, when it calls for the control, it's going to pull the one with the lower sequence number. Right? This is how we can start to come into some scenarios where we're overriding controls. Right? So I can have both features turned on, but the one with the lower sequence will override, and it will be the one that goes to the page. Or, same control, but we set the allow multiple to true. What ends up happening this time around is both controls get loaded, but this time the sequence property determines the order that they get loaded in. Right, so that's basically a sort of visual rundown of how it all works. But rather than looking at pretty pictures and slides, let's flick over and have a bit of a demo, and I'll show you how some of this actually works. So, basically, what I've got here is my standard SharePoint solution. Now, I've created a quick little control here that I'm going to use just to demonstrate what's happening. So, just inheriting from control, a very basic little thing, one property called dashboard text. And in my onload method, I'm actually using something here called the SP monitored scope. Who's familiar with that, just out of curiosity? Yep, cool, here's another little tidbit for you. Who's familiar with the developer dashboard? Yeah? What this actually does, SP monitored scope, is it actually writes a message out to the developer dashboard, and inside the using statement here, it'll tell me how long that code took to execute when I'm looking at the execution path in the developer dashboard. So if I'm trying to debug specific parts within my web parts or my controls, I can use this to determine, you know, the amount of effort SharePoint's putting into individual pieces of code. All right, so a good habit to get into putting that into your code. As you can see, I'm being lazy here. I'm saying just sleep for 100 milliseconds and output whatever the property of my control is. So, onto our first delegate control. Really basic example. So, as I mentioned, delegate controls are all just features. So we're driving stuff through our elements XML files. And you can see here, I'm working with the control tag within my feature. So there's a few different properties on here that we can set. The first one is control assembly. Let me just minimize this way for a minute. Touchy mouse. Okay, so control assembly and control class. This is how I'm telling SharePoint, this is the control that I would like you to go and load. All right, from this assembly, this class. I'm giving it an ID. All right, so in this case, additional page head. Again, if you've gone and had a look at the default master pages, you'll see in that head section of the document, there's a SharePoint delegate control called additional page head. So by putting a delegate control here, we're telling, you know, load this control in the head part of the document. And I'm not having to change the master page to do that. And a sequence of 100, which is sort of irrelevant in this case. And my property here of AU TechEd, the additional page head delegate control, has loaded. So I'm able to set all the properties of my controls here and have SharePoint apply those properties to the control that gets loaded. So I can set any kind of property here that can go from a string type to whatever the property type is. So it will try to pass it out for me. So I can set integer values, I can set GUIDs and things like that, as long as it can be passed from a string to the type that we're trying to apply. So back to my demo here. So here's my stock standard SharePoint site. And here's a list of features I've got. So I'm going to turn on the developer dashboard first. All right, so we can see down here I've got, you know, a bunch of events, authentication's happening, pages loading, web parts are loading. Now I'm going to come back here and turn this feature on and just go back and refresh the page. You can now see in my loading bit down here that I've got my additional page head delegate control loaded. Right? So by turning a feature on, I've added functionality to my page. I haven't changed the master page. I haven't done anything else. Now, the beauty of things like this is that by working with particularly the out-of-the-box delegate control IDs, I can push functionality into system pages that you're not normally allowed to touch. Right? Through the additional page head thing, it's in all of the application master pages. So I can start driving functionality out in a way that is supported without having to modify files in the 14 Hive. So a little bit further than that, let's go on to another example in the right project, Brian. And we'll have a look at a Webpart control. Sorry, I've forgotten which one I'm doing. So this time here, I'm overriding one called the small search input box. So again, looking at the out-of-the-box master page, if you actually come back and have a look, this search box here in the top right corner, that's actually loaded as a delegate control, which is great because it gives us some scope to override it. So what I've done with mine is I've set the sequence number to 2, right? Ridiculously low, so it's going to override any of the out-of-the-box stuff. So if I come back and I turn that feature on and refresh my page, you'll see the search box is no longer there. My control was injected into the page instead, which doesn't actually render anything visually. It just goes and adds another small search control there for me. Now, on just another example, which is probably a little bit more useful, what if I wanted to change the way that search box behaves? I'm going into Webpart Child. So here, I'm using small search input box. I'm setting the sequence to 1. So again, overriding the one that I just turned on. And this time, I'm saying go and use that same search box X control, which is the search box that's there, but I'm specifying a bunch of different properties. So a different URL for the advanced search page. I'm specifying properties and width and things like that. So now if I come back and I turn that feature on and refresh my page, my search box is back. It's asking me if I'm looking for cake, and I've got an advanced link which is going to send me off to Bing for the advanced search. Right, so again, I haven't had to change any of the out-of-the-box pages to do that. I'm using my own features to drive functionality. So taking it a little bit further than that, integrating delegate controls into web parts. So the example I gave earlier was around having a logon web part and using a delegate to drive the logon control appearing there. Now, what I'm going to do in this case is delegate control web part. So really basic web part here is I'm creating a delegate control and saying its ID is simple web part demo. That's fine. And it's going to load multiple controls. So now what I'm able to do in my... wrong elements file. In my delegate web part controls, I'm pushing out 3 of these delegate controls. Again, I'll install my simple one with a sequence to say 100, 200, and 300, and first, second, third. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to come back and add that web part to the page. Delegate control web part. Stop editing. And coming back down here, you see 1, 2, and 3 in that order. So my web part is now having content driven into it dynamically based on features. Right? So if I need to be able to quickly enable or disable a particular piece of functionality that I'm rolling out, I've now got the ability to do it through just turning features on and off rather than having to worry about doing a redeploy or ripping something out of an XML file or doing something potentially dodgy that you shouldn't be doing in production anyway. Now, the last example I've got for you is a little bit more complex. What we're going to do in this one is I'm going to create a series of tabs with delegate controls. So I've got another web part here, and I've done it as a visual web part this time. What I'm actually doing in my code here is I'm programmatically requesting all of the delegate controls. Right, so I'm actually just creating a delegate control, as you can see here, and specifying an ID and allow multiple. And what I'm actually doing here is with a little bit of reflection telling it to go and create your child controls, so let SharePoint go away and figure out what delegate controls I need, and then I'm just going to iterate through its controls collection and take those and do something with them. And what I'm actually doing is rendering out a navigation element to do some tabs and putting each control on the page and setting its visibility based on the tab that I select. So here's the actual controls. Now, this one's different because it's a user control rather than me specifying the actual individual control there. Now, this is the other way that you could do delegate controls. So what you can see here is I'm still using the control element. And let me just make that a little bit bigger for you. But this time, rather than specifying an assembly and a class, I'm specifying the control SRC property, which lets me point to a specific ASCX user control and have it loaded in instead of my other control. Now, I could still do a visual web part, or I could still do any other control. Essentially, anything that is a web control that can go on a page can be a delegate control. So with that in mind, I've got some properties here around what I want my tab names to be and this and that. So now when I go and add that web part to the page, that's not right. There we go. You can see I've got a little tab control here with the text being loaded from those ASCX pages. Right. Now, the theory here is that, say, I've developed my little tab control and I've left it with a client, and they've had another vendor come in that needs to be able to add a tab to this. They can do that by just deploying another delegate control to that same ID. They don't need to touch my code. They don't need to mess around with anything that I've already written. There's that framework in place for them to just simply push out another delegate and have it appear with the rest of the tabs on the screen. Right. So with a little bit of forethought and whatnot, we can take these delegate controls and start doing some really advanced scenarios with them. So with that demo to an end. So wrapping up on the delegate controls piece, like I said, they allow us to do some really cool stuff with templating our designs. All right? Gives us lots of flexibility to be able to move really quickly. They give us functionality to do things through the UI rather than having to redeploy and configure. And like I said, we can use that as a framework to be able to do some really advanced sort of stuff. Moving on, Elaine.
Cool. Okay, we're going to talk about web templates. Hands up if you've built a site definition before? Oh, wow, how fun was that? So in SharePoint 2007, we had the concept of a site definition, and basically this was designed so that you could create some files, put them on the file system, and they would be used to provision sites. Now, unfortunately, there were some big problems in how site definitions worked. And if anyone ever did a SharePoint upgrade with a site definition, you probably hit a bunch of those. So typically what you'll find is once you do a site definition, you create the site off it, you can't ever change that site definition again. It has to stay exactly the same on disk. So, of course, business users never change their minds, so that'll work completely fine. But what happens in production is, there's always going to be a change, and you're going to end up with 5, 6, 7 site definitions called, site def 1, 2, 3, or you make a mistake and you go and hack the site def and you redeploy it and all the existing sites will break. And I've even seen what happens in some cases is they'll appear to work until you do a service pack or until you do an upgrade. So it can be a really, really dangerous approach because site definitions are very, very bound to the sites that are created off them. Also, we all love the cloud these days. Site definitions don't work in Office 365. Because we can't put files on disk in Office 365, there would be no way to do site definitions up there. So Microsoft's had to sort of invent another way that we could do these customizations without putting things on disk. There is a little bit of a better technique with site definitions. So what people typically do is they'll do feature stapling. So you'll have a site definition that's very, very minimal, barely anything in it, and then you'll actually deploy all the functionality you want through features. That's a lot better than doing all your logic in the site definition because it does give you an upgradable structure. But you still have that problem of everything being bound to the site def. So basically the idea is in 2010... we should never, ever, ever do site definitions, except for one little edge case, which I'll talk about in a minute. They invented a new concept called web templates. This is the preferred approach that will replace site definitions moving forward. A web template can be upgraded, because what happens is once you've created your web template, the site doesn't care about the web template anymore. Under the scenes, it is an out-of-the-box SharePoint site. What that means is Microsoft has to make sure your site will upgrade fine if it's created off a web template. If it's of a side diff, that's your own code. They don't care about that. So we can also do it in Office 365. Nothing goes on disk with a web template necessarily. We can do it up in the cloud. And the two caveats are, though, we can't do feature stapling. So because it is not bound to the site, the web template after creation, there's no way to do that feature stapling to say, hey, you know, when a site's created like this, run these features by traditional feature stapling. But there's another way we can do it, which I'll show you in the demo. The only time you don't want to use this is if you've actually got a multilingual site. Variations do not work with web templates. So it's definitely something to be wary of if you do have multilingual needs. Also, we still have a very similar approach where we're going to put most of our functionality into features. With 2010, they've actually added some nice functionality here where we can upgrade our features and perform actions. What will happen with a web template is if you change it, it won't go back and change all the sites that have already been created off it. How you're going to do that is through doing feature versioning. And there's really four separate elements to feature versioning that you can use. The first of these is a custom upgrade action, right? This is just run some code. It could be anything. You put your own code in there, very flexible. Anything you want to do, you can do on the feature upgrade. The other one is apply element manifest. That's for basically pushing new things into your features. So maybe you've got some new images, some page layouts, master pages, those kind of things. You create a new element manifest for those, and you use the apply element manifest in your feature versioning to push that out to as part of your feature. Map file is when paths of files need to change. So maybe you have changed your welcome page or something like that, and you actually want to redirect the URL from one to another. And there's also add content type field. This allows you to actually push new fields onto content types that you've created. That can be quite useful. Sometimes a lot of developers prefer to do that, though, with actually writing code in the custom upgrade action, because you've got a bit more flexibility then to do a lot of if-then tests. But if you have a simple content type that you know end users haven't modified, and you just want to push out a couple of new fields, that's when you'd use that add content type field element. So let's have a look at some of this. Okay, so I'm going to show you how it works before we actually jump into some code, just to give you a little bit of context. So basically the whole idea is that we want to be able to create a new site collection with our own things in it. So you'll see here that what I've got is down below, there's basically my own little section popping up here called Tech Ed Publishing, and I can create my own site based off that. If I go off and provision that, it will actually create me a nice new site. And, you know, my awesome graphic design skills that you can see here, we've got some components in here. Basically, we flick the master page across, we put a custom logo up here, we've got a custom welcome page, which has its own content type, the page layout, and a little field that we just added. So there, you know, your basic elements that we push out when that site was provisioned. Also, if we have a look here, so in the master page gallery, we can see we've got our master page and our page layout, which has gone into there. We've got our custom content type under a heading. But, you know, unfortunately, the business users didn't really like the paint job I did on that logo up there, so now they're going to ask me to update it. When you upgrade a solution, you can't just deploy the new package. It doesn't actually run the feature upgrade for you, so you've got to have some way to do that. There's a couple of different ways. You could run the configuration wizard, and that'll do all the solutions. You could run PowerShell to do it. Or I've just done a nice little UI customization, which is what I've added down here. So I've basically just thrown a custom action into the site settings page. And all it does is it lists through all the features and has a look and says, is there one that's ready to upgrade? And in this case, we've got our one here that's ready to upgrade. So theoretically, when I hit that, it should run my code. And there you go, my nice little logo's gone. So that's the process that I've got where I can actually go through, deploy a web template, have my sites created off it, and then perform upgrades to it later. So let's have a look at how this plays out in Visual Studio. Okay. We've got a number of different elements here, and one of the things before we jump into the code that I wanted to highlight is I've actually followed specific naming conventions in here. Now, the actual naming convention isn't important. What's important is that any team you're working through with invents some kind of convention and structure and sticks consistently to those. What you can find here, the reason I've named things this way is because I want to know in Visual Studio, just by looking at it, A, what scope something is, and B, what it does. So, for example, this is a farm-level feature that deploys, you know, my web template. This is a site-level one, and these two, you can see a web. I don't have to go, you know, in here and have a look at that at all. Obviously, the end user sees a much more relevant title that's something that's important to them. Also, down below here, I've got everything in nice little folders. And again, I followed naming conventions for all these items. Things like my modules, I just prefix with MO and property bag PB, those kind of things. Because what you'll find is as your projects get really large, when you come into this area here and you're adding things to and from your features, you don't want to have to look into your code and go, oh, is it called this and what's this one and what's that? I can very easily tell through my naming exactly which element I want to grab and where I want to put it into my solution. All right, so let's have a look at some of the bits and pieces. We'll start actually with the web template itself. If we have a look down here, very basic elements file. It's got the web template in there. You can see I've actually based it off an out-of-the-box one. So that's what it is under the covers. It's just your normal CMS publishing site. And I've just given it my own display category. When I deploy things like web templates and content types and fields, I like them to go into their own categories just so I know that it's my customization, not something that Microsoft or someone else has done. And if we actually look at the onet.xml file, this is where actually everything happens for a web template. So going through here, you can see that I've got my configuration down here. And we might make that a little bit larger. Get rid of this guy. Then I go into provisioning all my features. So this is instead of feature stapling. All I do is I put in my onet.xml and just say, these are the features I want to run, and this is the scope they're going to run at. So here we've got a lot of the out-of-the-box ones, you know, and I've just got sort of some comments in here so that we know what it is. I've actually based mine off publishing, which is why you're seeing all the publishing prerequisites and the view lock forms, those kind of things. So if any of these, if I'm creating a sub-site with this web template and any of these prereqs aren't turned on at the site collection level, it'll actually not allow the site to be created because I'm, you know, relying on publishing. Then we go down and after the site features, we have our web features. And here, so I've got, we'll go into this feature in a minute. Basically what I'm doing is when you create a sub-site, you actually have to manually trigger the site collection level features of your own if you want them to run. Sub-sites won't actually automatically run them for you. So I've got some code here that does that. And then we've just got a bunch of the out-of-the-box things. We're setting publishing. That's where I set my master page URL, for example, and some features for navigation and my custom welcome page. So once you get familiar with that structure, it's actually quite easy to add and remove things you want. You know, typically you'll just sort of copy and paste that kind of structure and maybe you change your welcome page features and all the various things around. Obviously, if you were creating a team site rather than one based off publishing, you're going to have a bunch of different features up here. But you can actually have a look at the Microsoft sort of site defs and pull most of the features you need out of that and just paste them into the right places. Okay, so as you can see, I've got some normal stuff in here which anyone who's created SharePoint solutions is probably pretty familiar with, so we won't go into the extra fields or the content types or those kind of things. One thing that is definitely worth doing is this property bag identifier. Very basic. All I'm doing is I'm stamping the site created with my web template with an identifier. Because as I mentioned before, once I've created this site, it looks like an out-of-the-box site. If I look at the type of it, it'll say it's CMS publishing. It won't say it's, you know, my web template. So this is the identifier I use if I need to go back and do some PowerShell or whatever it is on my site. I can actually look into the property bag and go, oh, yep, this was actually created with this web template. In here, I might even use versioning. So I might want to say which version of the web template it was created by. So I know, you know, version one, or you might want to do a date scheme on it. Otherwise, there's literally no way that you can tell that it was created with your web template versus the out-of-the-box stuff. Also, if we have a look at our basic features. So I'm deploying this as a farm web template. As you saw, I could create a new site collection off it. You can actually do them site-scoped, and if you were doing Office 365, that's what you'd want to do. So you wouldn't want to be doing a farm level one, because it just won't allow you to do that in 365. But here, we've just got a very basic deploying that web template at the farm level. At the site level, we're doing just pushing through our master page. We've got our feature upgrade customization in there with a custom action. And we've got our fields and page layouts as well. And then at the web level, we'll jump into that one later. This is where I've done my property bag and my content type binding and just setting actually that welcome page. If we jump quickly into a little bit of code. This is the feature I mentioned earlier. So when you create a subsite, it won't automatically trigger your site collection level features. And this is the code that I'm using to do that. So basically what I do is I just pass in properties of the features I want it to enable. And as you can see here, I'm just checking, you know, if it's web, I'll actually go and just verify that the features of the GUIDs that I passed in are created and just activate them at the top. So nice and simple. Up on this one here, we've got my feature upgrading. So you'll see in any one of these, any one of the feature receivers that you add, you've always got your feature upgrading there, so you just have to uncomment it and put whatever code you want in there. It won't actually run, though, unless you put a custom, some kind of custom a feature upgrade action. So whether that's one of those map files or an upgrade action like I'm doing here where I'm running my own code. Otherwise, it just won't trigger. But once you put that in there, as soon as you do the upgrade, it'll just jump into your own code and run whatever you're doing here. Obviously, very basic. I'm just resetting my site logo back to what it was originally. And again, that's a nice little feature to do if you are mucking around with things like site logos, master pages, setting them through code. You can really easily just push the original setting into the property bag. Then if you ever do need to revert stuff, you can actually clean up. That's a really nice sort of way if you're going to have lots of customizations on your environment. You want to make sure that this stuff can be undone pretty easily. So that's what we're doing there. And the last bit I was going to show is just my little page that we use for upgrade. Oops, or not. Okay, so this is the code that you can actually see when I hit upgrade on that page. So basically, I'm going through and just enumerating my features. You can see here I'm listing the features that need upgrade, and then I'm listing the features, all the existing features, just bunging them into some labels and tables. And this is as simple as it is to upgrade a feature. It's just literally grab the feature, call feature.upgrade. So you can see how you could very easily do that same code through PowerShell as well. If you had lots of sites you wanted to iterate over, probably be preferable to do it via PowerShell. This kind of approach is really nice, though, if you're having to deal with hosted solutions. So, you know, often hosters get a bit funny about running exes or PowerShell scripts or those kind of things, but I can actually trigger my feature upgrade just with the click of the button because of this customization I've deployed. Cool. So, all right, so in summary, web templates replace site definitions for most situations. If you are doing SharePoint 2010 development, do not do site definitions unless you happen to need multilingual stuff in there. It does take a little bit to get to learn that structure, but there's some great resources up online, and there's actually a whole bunch of labs that have just gone up that we can point you to the URLs of that you can go through and basically learn how to do web templates step by step. Make sure that you plan your structure. As you saw, there was quite a few elements, and that was just a web template that was doing a master page, a page layout, content types and some fields. Pretty common situation, but quite a lot of structure in there. So think about your naming, think about your folders. How is this thing going to play out once it grows? And use your feature upgrading or some scripts so that you can push out changes to your template as you go.
Cool. Alrighty. Who's still absorbing information at this point? Are we all still awake? Let's talk service applications. We'll change that, trust me. So who's familiar with what a service application is, just before I start? Cool. Now, how many people have heard that you can write a custom service app? How many people have been told don't write custom service apps? Just, yeah, okay, cool. We'll get into this then. So here's SharePoint 2010. Yes, good old architecture slide. I'm sure we've all seen it a bunch of times before. What we're specifically interested in is this piece here, the service applications. So when we start talking about SharePoint 2010, everything got changed into this whole service application architecture from what was the shared service provider in 2007, and they added a whole lot of extra stuff. Now, the thing with service applications is you can extend it and create custom ones to do whatever you need it to do. So things like Project Server is actually a service application. I've got a sticker on my laptop that proves it. Fast is a service application that you can build in there. Office web applications has got service applications, right? But specifically, third-party things, right? So third-party vendors can write service applications, or we can write our own service applications. So why would you write a service application? There's a few different reasons. The first one is scalability. Right? So when you have service applications, it becomes really, really easy to scale functionality out. For the fact that all I need to do to add another server running my service is just go into central admin, go to the server, and say, turn this on. Right? And all of a sudden, I've added another server, and it's now starting to service things. What SharePoint does is it's actually got an internal round-robin load balancer, so that whenever a web application calls to a service app, it'll start just bouncing them around between the different servers to take advantage of the fact that you've got more than one server running it. Also, the beauty of that is if you've got multiple servers running a specific service app, if one of them drops out, the round robin will just drop it out and continue providing functionality, right? So it's a way of adding a bit of redundancy as well. The second reason you do it is to share and consume data. All right? So one of the things that got added to 2010 with this architecture change was the ability to publish a service application across farms. Right? So if I've got a service application doing something in farm A, and I want farm B to be able to know exactly what it's doing, I can actually publish it so that farm B can use that same service application, and it's essentially, for all intents and purposes, it looks like it's running locally over there, just the requests are being sent off to farm A. Right? So again, we don't have to build anything for that. The architecture's there for us to take advantage of it. Right? And the last reason is around performance and stability. Right? So service applications are a much better platform for building long-running operations. Right? So look at the out-of-the-box ones, things like search and search crawling and all that sort of stuff. It's much better suited than things like timer jobs, for example, because if you write a custom timer job to go and do something that takes a long time, usually around about 45, 50 minutes, I think it is, it sort of just dies and restarts and gets stuck in this infinite loop of killing your server. Service applications are much better suited to be able to do long-running things. So again, if you need something with that kind of time frame to it, you should be looking to this as an architecture to do it. So again, with the pictures, here's a bit of an overview of some of the objects as developers we need to sort of be aware of when we start developing service applications. So at the top of the screen there, we have our SP farm, right? This represents our whole farm and everything within it. Now, over to the left, we have SP server, right? So this represents individual servers that have been added to our farm. Across to that, we have SP service. This represents an individual service within the farm. Now, the arrows below those, we have SP service instance. All right, so this is where we say, I have this service, i.e. you know, search or office web apps or project server or whatever. It's running on a specific server. It is an instance of that service running on a server. Right, and below here, we have the SP service application. Now, so to sort of explain this one, you can have multiple service applications, each with their own individual configurations and whatnot, but they will both actually run within the same service instance. All right, so when I enable, for example, if I've got, say, multiple user profile services, why you do that, I'm not quite sure off the top of my head, but it was just the first one that came to mind. If I have two different web applications, both using the two different service applications, what will happen is if they hit the same server, it'll figure out which service application and configuration it should use and manage that for us, despite the fact that physically within IIS, it is actually just the one application folder there that's running. Over this side here, away from our application server on the web front end, we have this thing called an SP service proxy. All right. Now, what this does is the proxy is essentially responsible for making the requests to say, hey, I need the service application to do something for me. And then we have the SP service application proxy below it, which does a lot of the grunt work for us. Now, through this proxy here, we're enabling calls back to our service from, you know, web front ends and from other places within SharePoint without having to call directly to the service itself, right? So this is where the load balancing and the round robin thing comes in. So how do we build a custom service app? Here it is in 9 easy steps. And I love that step 1 is create service application. But no. So we start off, we write our actual service, right? Write the code that's doing the grunt work for us, doing what we need it to do. The second step is we create our WCF service application endpoints. Right, so a service application is just WCF services that get provisioned out. So if you've had a look around IIS on one of your SharePoint boxes, you'll see that SharePoint goes and adds that web services application, which runs on, was it port 32843 or something ridiculous like that. Our WCF services for service apps get provisioned into there. Next, write some installation code for your service app. Right, so do I need to do things like provision databases? Do I need to change configuration settings or anything when I install it? Write code that does that. I need to stop moving so much. Install and provision your service application. Step 5, create your proxy. All right, so we've created the service application. Now we need to create the proxy, which is going to allow access to the application. Again, write some code that does the installation on that, and install and provision your proxy. Last but not least, step number 8 and 9 down here, is create something that actually consumes your service application, because there's not a whole lot of point in writing one that doesn't actually get used. And that could be web parts, it could be PowerShell scripts, it could be, you know, whatever you need, depending on the particular type of application you're writing. So let's actually get in and have a look at some of the code for this. So, I'm breaking my microphone. Let's flip this over here. Mic swap. That's right, if this makes it to the video on the internet, I'm not going to be happy. Okay, so here I have my service application in, again, true, here's one I prepared earlier style. So talking through the steps that I just mentioned as to how you'd go and build one, I'm going to show you through some of the code that actually goes into building a service application. So the first thing we've got is let's go and create our actual service application that does all the work. So we've got a really, really complicated example for you here today, people. Here's the code. This is what we're doing.
Slow down.
All right. Do we need to go over this? We can do it. Okay, so we've got a service application that's going to add two numbers together, right? So you can see what I've got here is I've just created myself an interface, and I'm inheriting from service contract, so you know, WCF kind of thing. Here's the interface for my service. All right. So beyond that, let's go and have a look at my custom service class. Okay, so what we have here is a custom service. We're inheriting from SPIIS web service, and also implementing iService administration, right? So here is essentially the service that's going to run, and we've got a few methods on here, such as create application, right, where we go through and go and provision things like databases and things like that. We can create the proxy for it. Moving down through the code here, we've got, get the description for it and things like that. So these are all methods that get called out from when you do it, creating a service application through the user interface, essentially, kind of thing. Doing things like, returning URLs and that get called when referring to it. Beyond that, we've got a class now for the instance. Right? Again, fairly basic sort of thing, but those are the classes that sort of go together to say, okay, here's the actual application. Now, after that, we need to go and wrap in some endpoints. So I've got custom service application. Okay, so you can see up here, I've got my class here, custom service application. I'm inheriting from SPIS web service application. And I'm also implementing my contract that I created earlier, so my interface with my add method. I've tagged it with a few attributes up here around the backup behavior attributes, service behavior, so some things around the instance context mode, so we're saying use per session, concurrency, it runs as multiple, things like that. And moving down through some of the stuff in here, you can see I've got my create method, which I'm doing things like create my database, and we'll go into that class in a minute. So I don't actually need a database to add two numbers together, just in case anyone was wondering. This is just to have the code in there. Although I'm sure we could probably say shove the numbers into the database, but we thought just adding the numbers together was complicated enough. Moving down through here, I was seeing code where we're creating my new service application and pushing it out, and I'm adding endpoints to it. Right, so adding service endpoints around the TCP and HTTP stacks, both with plain and SSL. Right, so other methods running down through this class here, a few properties around setting it up, a provisioning and unprovisioning methods, so we can add functionality into there as required. We've got methods to hook into around if the process identity gets changed, so again, being aware of that and being able to drive changes if we need to. Returning some URLs around what's the URL that goes to with managing and properties and things like that, so we can deploy custom pages into the layouts and into the admin directories if we need to. This one's kind of interesting. So what we can do is we can actually specify custom access rights for our application. So in this case, I'm saying you can either have full control, you can have modify, or you can have read. And I'm also specifying some individual access rights. So you can say, well, you can have full control, you can add numbers, you can subtract numbers, or you can just read. So again, you can build some models around your individual application to set permissions accordingly. So you know how you can set who can administer and who can have what kind of control within a service application. We can do that same thing within our custom ones too. And you'll see down at the bottom here, all the stuff to implement my add method. You see there I've got my add with 1 and 2. The line here, though, is I'm actually saying demand access for that add right that I defined earlier. All right, so this is a way that I can make sure that I've said, yes, you can add those two numbers before I actually let my service application go and do it. If the person doesn't have adequate rights, that line will go and throw an exception and get passed back down. Okay, so all right, next from here, we've also got a couple more things around the actual web services themselves. So here, you can see I'm deploying my actual SVC file, right, to a mapped directory, which is pushing out to the web services folder, right? So if you go and have a look at your 14 Hive, under that there's a directory called web services, and then a bunch of subfolders for individual service applications. And this is where the physical files live for those services. Now, with that, I've got the ability to, so here's a stock standard service host, painted with a couple of attributes around the actual service and the factory class that it's going to use. Right, so it's pretty stock standard WCF stuff. But I'm also able to specify a custom web config file as well, right, which can carry specific attributes to my application if I need to do it that way. We all keeping up at this point? Anyone got any questions? Yeah, cool. Love it. I'll just keep going before anyone actually puts their hand up with a question. So now that we've got all that there, we have some installation code. How do I install my service app? Now, as with all the out-of-the-box stuff, it's done through PowerShell commandlets, so what we have here is some custom PowerShell commands. So here's my install commandlet. So my class install custom service, you can see I'm inheriting from SP commandlet. Right, so this is a way of us specifying specific SharePoint PowerShell commands that we can deploy out to our farms. As with custom PowerShell commandlets, who's actually written a custom PowerShell commandlet in this room? Anyone? Show of hands. A couple of people. So we paint it with the commandlet attribute up here. We specify a verb that goes at the start of it. So if you've ever noticed with PowerShell commands, it's always a verb then an action kind of thing. So in this case, I'm saying install, and the item here is custom service. So when this gets deployed, the PowerShell command will be install-custom service. So what we do down here is we're just overriding a couple of methods. The one here that's doing the work is the internal process record method. Now, we do a couple of validation things to make sure people pass us the values we need. And then what we do is we go through, get our service object, checking if it's null, basically saying, does it already exist? Because in our case, we're just saying you can have one just to keep this kind of simple. If not, go and create the new custom service, and we'll get to that class in a minute. And at the bottom here, we're going and creating an instance of it. All right, so thinking back to that diagram we had there, we have instances of a service on each server. If you don't have any instances of it, it's not actually running anywhere. You've created it and configured it, but if there's no instances, you can't actually call it because it's not running. So that's the service application part of it. Next, we need to do the proxy. All right. So after we do our proxy, which looks something like this, a custom application proxy. Wait, no, that's the PowerShell command. Custom application proxy. Okay, so you can see we're inheriting from a class here called SPIS Web Service Application Proxy. Starting to get into some nice long class names. Got to love that. But methods that are in here is we've got a few things that we have, like around the load balancer gets provided as a read-only property. We've got our channel factory. So essentially what we're doing here is setting the proxy up to be able to call to that WCF service that we've provisioned. Now, coming down in here, we've got a few methods that we have around, so creating our channel factory. Right, and we've got some scripts around that. Moving down through, we've got our invoke method. All right, so this is essentially how the proxy can call back to the service application. So we pass in a context and a code to run on application proxy, which is essentially a delegate. Right, so we pass in the code that needs to get executed back on the service. So from here, you know, just a couple of validation checks as well. Moving down through our execute on channel method. So this is where, again, we're using a monitored scope for logging purposes. But we're getting the appropriate channel, setting up a WCF stuff and our code block and going initiating it, hanging out for some things like a timeout exception or not being able to find endpoints and things like that. So catering for potential errors. And still moving through here. There's a lot of code for adding two numbers together, isn't it? Seriously, it's... getting the specific configuration for the endpoint, so we specify a way for it to be able to figure out the specific endpoint it should be using based on the URI, so things like HTTP versus HTTPS, that sort of thing. But moving all the way down into the bottom here, again, provision and unprovision. But look, we've got an add method. All right. So again, this is where we go and actually do that execution. So using that execute on channel method that we defined earlier, we provide a delegate, which is implementing our contract. All right, so again, go and add two numbers together. So that's the bit that's actually going to go and make the call for us. All right, so again, once we've got our proxy sorted out, we create a way to go and install the proxy. So again, another custom PowerShell command. This one's a bit simpler. Just, you know, if it's there, create it. And if it's not, don't. All right, so we've got our proxy there so that people can, the code can call out to our service. And... last but not least, we want to do something that's going to consume our service application. Now that we've got all this framework in there to say, I want to send a couple of numbers and add them together, how do we actually call it now? In this case, we wanted to write a PowerShell command so we can call via PowerShell, hey SharePoint, add these numbers together. So again, we've got our SP commandlet. And I'm specifying, you know, an array of integers as what it's going to take in, service context as well, so that way it knows what URL it's got to call out to. And we come down to our internal process method. Again, we do a couple of quick checks to make sure we've specified the appropriate values. But we come down here and we create a new custom service client. So this is the object, and I skipped over that one, so we'll go have a quick look at that, which is essentially so the client-side class that we call out to go and do this add for us. All right, so its add method goes and calls out to my proxy with the invoke method, sends the numbers off, and returns the sum back out. So PowerShell's calling through to that class, and what we've actually done with the PowerShell command is said, we'll pass in an array of numbers, and it'll just take the first two and add them, and then add the third and the fourth and fifth, so it just sort of loops over, making multiple calls to the service app as it needs to. So, with that all done, now let's push this out to SharePoint and actually create ourselves an instance of this. So, here's some PowerShell that does that. So, what I'll do is just minimize that out a bit and get rid of that. So, starting off just by loading up my PowerShell commandlets, the SharePoint PowerShell commandlets. Stepping through, I am, first of all, installing my custom service. All right, so there's that custom PowerShell command that we created earlier. Next, I'm going to create a service application. Right, so we've created the service. Now we're creating the service application. So from here, we're just doing a quick get to see if it already exists. If it doesn't, so if service app is equal null, we call new custom service application. So again, there's a custom command that we've written to go and create a new service app. So the application within the service. Moving further down through the PowerShell here, after that, we're going to configure some permissions on it. So in this case, we're just taking the currently logged on user and specifying that they should have full control over our application that we've just created. Last, we come down and create a proxy. So again, we had a custom command there for install proxy, which I didn't show you, but it looks pretty much the same as the other one. So we've installed the proxy, then we create the proxy, again, coming through, create proxy with our custom commands. And then last but not least, we start an instance of it. So F5, I'm going to run all that. So it's currently setting it up, creating my service application. Cool, so we can see it's spat it back out there. And what I'm going to do, we'll just go back into Central Admin real quick, and I'll just show you that it's there. Wants to have a think about it. Any questions at this point? Yes and no. There are some limitations around some of the things they can do, but for the most part, you know, because it's running, generally going to be running out as one of the higher privileged accounts in your farm, there's a fair bit of stuff you can do with them, yeah. Yep. Okay. Not entirely certain off the top of my head. Have a chat to me afterwards and we'll have a look at that one. Okay, so here I am. So what the code we're actually looking at here is actually available on MSDN, right? So this, if you go and have a look at the documentation around creating service applications, this was actually part of a training kit that got published up on MSDN, so you can grab all of this code, and there's actually, I think, a video walkthrough there as well with the guys that put it together that you can grab and go through that as well. So you don't have to figure it out, because let's face it, this is a lot of code to write to start with just to add two numbers. So, but anyway, you can see here, I'm at my service applications page. I've got my custom service app. All right, so it's there, it's provisioned, and it's got its proxy. So now let's actually call it and see if it works. I've got another PowerShell script here. And basically what we're doing is saying, here's the URL of the site. Here's two numbers, one and two, and invoke custom service. So this was the custom PowerShell command we wrote. That would go and invoke it. All right, so run that one. Numbers come together, adding one and two. So first call, it's spinning the application pool up there. I'm defending why it takes so long to add them. There we go. 1 plus 2 equals 3. And thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. And just to prove it's not all smoke and mirrors, let's chuck some extra numbers in here and run it again. And somebody tell me if I'm right adding this up quick. Yeah, we do. There we go. So, yep, it's actually working. It's adding two numbers together. Isn't life grand? The other thing also worth knowing, if we flick over to my database server and I open SQL, not that one, bad Brian, connect. You see, in amongst my litter of databases, I've got custom service DB named with the GUID on the end of it. So I didn't specify a database name when I created the service app, so it's done the same behavior as the out-of-the-box ones do with those hideous GUIDs, but it's created the database for me using a SQL script that was part of my initial code. Right, so when I provisioned it, it's pushed that out for me, and that's that. So that's service applications, ladies and gentlemen. So, wrapping that part up, things to know about service applications. Know when to build them and when to use alternatives. As you saw, there's a lot of code. It's not a simple undertaking to go and build it, but there are plenty of valid scenarios for when you would want a service app. And last, understand the framework when you're doing it, so that way when you start writing bits of code and you need to start debugging bits and pieces, you know where to look, because like you saw, there's a lot of moving parts in there and there was a lot of code that I did go over fairly quickly. But go back and have a look and understand what is actually going on before you try to start diving in and writing too much code. Elaine. Yeah.
Okay, so we're just going to run through a bunch of quick tips now that'll hopefully help just with some of the other solutions that you're building. Then we'll jump into questions. So one of the things when you're building a larger solution is you're going to think about how you're going to divide things up into separate WSPs. But don't go overboard. I've seen 60 solutions, like 60, you know, for basic functionality. That's kind of crazy. Every solution package that you add will add overhead, both in your deployment and in running on the server. So you need to think about a way of how you're actually going to work out how many do you need. Personally, I like to think about how I'm actually going to deploy them. If one is never going to run without the other, well, why bother splitting them up, right? You know, you may as well put all your light components together. Anything that's going to be deployed and is very reliant on each other, try to group them into the same sort of WSP. Within your WSP, think about naming and structure, and even within your features and everything else that you're putting in there. And if you can, avoid cross-dependencies. There's some nasty things that'll happen in there. If you try to deploy a resource from one solution package and you try to do something to it from another solution package, you can end in nasty situations where it'll either not overwrite or it may overwrite and then you retract one and it'll go missing, all kinds of nasty race situations. So try to avoid any kind of cross-dependencies between things and shared resources if you can. Also, good architecture is possible even with SharePoint. So many SharePoint solutions I see are just a bunch of business logic and UI stuff all jammed together in this nice little sort of, you know, presentation logic control. We don't have to build our solutions like that. I mean, you know, obviously that was a bit of a convoluted example with the service app you saw, but hey, guess what? There was a database involved. Databases are really good for storing relational data. Don't you know, bung everything into a SharePoint list always. We've got WCF services. You know, we've all been talking about SOA for a while now. Why not have services where they're appropriate? Have your business logic layer, have your UI presentation layer. Just because it's SharePoint, you don't have to jam all that together. Think about how you're going to deploy stuff and do this at the start of your project. What typically happens is developers go, oh, I'm only ever going to have this deployed once, but that's never the case. Your dev machine might break. You might get a new developer on board. At the very minimum, you're going to have to go through dev, test, and production. There's a bunch of deployments that are going to happen there. If you get the automation of that happening at the start, you're going to save bucket loads of time right throughout your project. And it's also going to help you with that structuring. You've actually got a repeatable deployment process involved. A couple of different ways you can do it. PowerShell, really nice way to do it. The other common approach is actually to push out a farm feature that'll do a timer job and run all your deployment tasks. That's really useful for when you can't run code interactively in a hosted environment, for example. And my favourite thing about lots of automation in your deployment is you don't have to write deployment documentation. You just go, here's a script, this is the 10 things it does, run that. I've seen 100-page deployment documents. No one's ever going to get through that. Also, have a think about what you're going to do with caching. Caching can be both a blessing and a curse. You know, people often go, oh, we've got a high load site, right, let's tick this box and turn on caching and it'll fix our performance problems. And in a bunch of cases it will, but it can also cause you issues if you don't know what you're doing. For example, if you turn on output caching, it's going to cache every single page. Pages like search results and other things that change only based on query string parameters, well, guess what? Everyone's going to see the same page. They're not going to, it's not going to take that query string parameter into account unless you specifically set that up in your cache profile. The other thing is, once you start turning on caching, things are getting cached in downstream devices. So, you know, if it's an internet site, things are being cached on the client browser, any proxy it goes between you and the client machine. So you've got to have a strategy for how you're actually going to update things like your master page, your CSS, or your images, if you suddenly need to do a rapid change and you can't wait for that cache timeout to happen. Through code, you have to be very careful with caching as well in SharePoint. Lots of the objects in SharePoint aren't thread safe. SPWeb is a common example of that. If you cache that, you can cause all kinds of chaos. And typically, you won't see it until you run in production because, you know, most devs, you know, you're just having single concurrent users and you won't see the strange things happening. So make sure if you are going to cache something, you do a lock, then you cache an object that is safe, like a data table, something very common like that. And there's really good examples of that up on MSDN. Also, think about how you're going to query objects. You know, I mentioned right at the start of the session, SharePoint grows really fast. You're not going to be wanting to for each through a lot of items. You've got to think about how you're going to query it when there's 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 items. What if you've got a lot of site collections? Search object model is a really good way to do some of this. It performs really well at very, very high load, and you get a bunch of caching for free. So have a look at the search object model if you do have to do some querying of a lot of data. It's a lot more flexible in 2010. They've added a lot more to the query syntax. You don't have to drop into full text. It's very, very easy to do. You've also got your portal sitemap provider, right? That's used for your navigation out of the box. So it's very good for low static data that's not going to change very often. The other thing you've got is SP query. So rather than doing for each, make sure you're doing an SP query and putting some kind of bound on that item. There's also a new item in there called the content iterator you can apply with SP query, and that gives you a way of doing very, very large queries. And again, there's a good example of that up on MSDN. Also, think about what's going to happen with throttling. SharePoint has all this stuff out of the box where your request will just stop if it hits certain load conditions. For example, if HTTP request throttling's turned on and, you know, typically the server gets too busy, all new requests won't actually get in. They'll start seeing server busy as a message. So you have to think about how you're going to handle that. The other real common one is list throttling. That's set to 5,000 items by default, right? So any operation, whether that's code, whether it's an out-of-the-box web part that tries to pull back more than 5,000 items, will get list throttled. You can certainly turn that list throttle up, but it can cause a lot of issues where you'll end up with table locks. So be very careful about that. You'd be better off looking at ways of coding properly to get around that. So use your SP query with your content iterator. Think about, you know, how you can only pull back small subsets of data. Also, there is actually an object model override you can use for the auditors and administrators, so you can have a higher object threshold. But that only works in code. You can't do that for the out-of-the-box web parts. Very important thing, though, is if you're devving as an admin, you're not going to see list throttling because list throttling does not apply to a machine admin. Of course, none of us do that, so that won't be a problem. But I've seen that happen in a lot of situations where code's running fine, it gets on a test. As soon as it's running with proper security, 5,000 items, bang, the code stops. So just think about those conditions. So, in summary, we've talked a little bit about delegate controls, web templates, custom service apps, and a few design tips at the end. Hopefully we've given you a good overview of why some of those things are important. And I guess we'll jump into
questions.
Go ahead. No, so you don't have to create a database with a service application. That is just in the example. So this is how you can do it.
Okay.
Right? There is no requirement to have a database for a service app.
Right. So what I was looking for then, how do we use that database?
So it gets included as a SP database object into the farm. That's from your service application. You're then able to go and look back up. So you get a reference to the database from the service application object and can query out to it from there,
okay.
I believe.
SharePoint will even handle backup and everything for you because of the way it's been registered. So it's a really, really nice approach in that regard.
Yeah. Question.
Does it create a database per instance? So if you have three clients...
Yeah, so if I create three service applications, it will create three databases, right?
But what about the three web apps use that?
Yeah, so three web apps are using three. So if a web app is using...
We need a whiteboard.
I do need a whiteboard. So the web applications using it is sort of irrelevant, right? So if I've got three web applications that I've configured, service applications I've configured. I'm confusing myself.
So if you, for example, let's say you had three different things querying it, it's not going to make a difference. You've got it running on three different application servers in your farm, one database. But if you provision separate instances, like we often do with managed metadata services, for example, you'll get different databases. Yep. Yep. One DB. Yep.
No, so the tenanting that happens at the web application level, right? So the association is at the web app. So the assumption is that you associate the web application to one service app, and that's the database that you've got there. If you need to tenant the data within the individual web application, then your service app needs to handle that itself.
Yeah, so unless... And there is a multi-tenancy model in SharePoint, but, wow, that would be 100 times more complicated than that code.
any other questions, guys? You, sir. Yes, we'll have blog posts or whatnot up. So, we'll find somebody to get the links out if you follow either of us on Twitter, blog.brianfarnhill.com. I don't know what your blog is, but the code will be made available. Yes, in the front. Is there an alternative for list definitions? Not so much.
Well, the syntax for when you do lists is a little bit different in that you just do the differential items in 2010. But yeah, it's the same. It's similar sort of structure.
Yeah. Yes and no. We can have a chat about that afterwards if you want to start talking in some detail there. Anything else? Was one over here?
Yep. Is there any real-world examples of custom service applications?
Project server.
Yeah.
Like I said, Microsoft's built other stuff in there. There's, I've no doubt in my mind that there are a bunch of third-party vendors who are working on shifting some of their custom things into service applications and whatnot, but I'm not aware of any products that are service apps outside of Microsoft's own sort of technology stack at this point.
Yeah, I know I've seen a number of custom solutions that have used it, typically for that high processing scenario. Not many commercial things are out there.
Yeah. In the back.
Is that? Okay, news good.
Yeah, so you
override functions.
No, well, in that case, you take the control. So, say I was trying to do something with a specific control, I would write a custom control that inherited from that one, and I would override the functions there and push that out as my delegate.
We're done.
I think we're all out of time. So on that note...